This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Later this hour, we will meet the father-son filmmaking team behind the new documentary, Southwest Florida's Mangrove Coast. It tells the story of the Rookery Bay National Estuary and Research Reserve's now 40-year effort, working to protect the fragile ecosystem between Marco Island and Naples. But first, a story published Sunday in the News Press by environmental reporter Amy Bennett Williams opens by saying, quote, with toxic algae fouling Southwest Florida's inland waterways and coastline last year, state health officials faced a flood of worried questions as people turned to them for crisis leadership. Some were specific. Were Caloosahatchee blue crabs safe to eat? Was it dangerous to breathe near the algae-choked canals? How about swimming in the Gulf? Others were systemic. Who posts warning signs? Was any agency monitoring illness reports? And would water and air be tested for toxins? End quote. The paper used public records requests to get a hold of internal emails sent by officials at the Florida Department of Health, which had remained mostly silent throughout last year's blue-green algae bloom, to try to shine some light on what was happening within the department. It's a fantastic piece of reporting, so we've invited Amy to go over it with us and with you. Amy Bennett-Williams, welcome back to Gulf Coast Live.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you again, and an amazing story. As always, we invite our listeners to join the conversation. The number to call is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK on Facebook. We're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So I'm going to start off with what led you to seek the internal correspondence of the Department of Health?
We sought the internal correspondence because they were not speaking to us externally. As the algae crises developed and deepened, I would routinely call them, just as you read, with everyday questions and with larger questions about responsibilities. And often I wouldn't get answers at all. Sometimes I would get answers that were completely off point, off topic. And then when the situation got to a point where we were really wondering who was supposed to do what, I could never get a conversation. I could not get an interview. I could not have any voice-to-voice communication with anyone other than a spokesman telling me to put questions in writing. And so it was because I was not able to bring to our audience what the agency was going through and what it wanted to communicate with the citizens of the state of Florida that I thought, well, maybe the only way to see what they're talking about intramurally is to ask for their emails. And, of course, they're all public record.
So give me an overview of the process that it took to get a hold of these emails.
Well, it took a while. Initially, we made a pretty broad request. We said, you know, could we please have any emails with keywords like cyanobacteria and Karenia brevis, the red tide organism, and came back with a figure from the health department saying that it was going to be well over $10,000 to get that request filmed.
So the newspaper has to pay for this.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Because staffers have to go over each email and redact any sensitive information, and they have to pull them. So there's some woman power involved in getting these. And finally, we wound up confining the request to two key officials, so the chief epidemiologist and another person who's in charge of disseminating information. And again, we kept it to keywords and we made the time period short. It was only from, I think, the end of May to September, which is when the worst of the crisis was happening. And finally, after literally months of back and forth, we got 2,661, I believe.
So you have 2,661 emails. Have you gone through them all yet?
I don't think I've laid eyes on every single email, but I've certainly skimmed through both of the sets. And there's duplication, of course. You know how with an email chain you get the six previous emails at the bottom of it. So I think that I have looked at, in general, most of them.
Were there any specific emails that stood out to you as surprising? Were you shocked to hear what people were saying to one another within the department?
It was within the department and also with other state agencies, because officials from the Department of Environmental Protection would write the Department of Health saying, hey, do you guys do this kind of testing, or who's responsible for this? And we do this and we refer them to you and then you refer them to us. And they sort of acknowledged the circularity, the frustrating circularity of this. And so we could see people who are on the state payroll going back and forth saying, I don't know, what do you do? And that was, I guess, a little surprising. I was hoping that there was a firmer sense of direction. And then the other thing that just was not shocking but sort of dismaying was how alarmed citizens were. And they would continually turn to the department for some guidance. You know, is it okay for my kids to breathe? Is it what about my pets? You know, the questions that any of us who lived through this had. And a lot of times, at least in the emails we saw, the officials didn't answer them or gave them very short formulaic responses and just referred them to a website. And there was really a pervasive sense of frustration from the citizenry. And, you know, from a department that is in charge of the health of the state's citizens and the officials get their salaries paid by the state's citizens, as one of those citizens, I was hoping to see a little more compassionate responsiveness. And so sort of what I experienced as a reporter, I was seeing others in our community experiencing as well.
It wasn't just not wanting to deal with the media. It was wanting to deal with anybody that had questions.
Yeah. And they did, you know, again, in their defense, they did answer a lot of these questions, but the answers were, if I had been a mama seeking advice about my toddler, I would not have come away reassured.
Well, a lot of it had to do with directing people to the website.
Correct.
I got that email.
Yeah.
I was directed to a website as a person looking for an interview.
And even the website and some of the responses that they gave us contained responses that other scientists said, wait, that's not right. At one point, they told us that there was, and I'm paraphrasing, but the message was, there's no potential for harm from airborne cyanobacteria toxins, which really a growing body of research contradicts. And they were just dispensing that as if it were gospel. And that wound up being another story, that some of what the Department of Health was saying, scientists very seriously disagreed with.
Mm-hmm. Back when the bloom was at its peak, about how many times did you try to get interviews with DOH officials? Do you remember a number?
Oh, gosh.
Can you ballpark it?
I would say, you know, when things were bad, several times a week I would call and send emails. And there was staff turnover. You know, one week I'd be talking to this person and then, oh, that person is gone. Please communicate with this person. Probably every week a dozen when things were worse. And I would try a variety of strategies. I would phone call or I would email or I would use their response form online. And again, in the department's defense, they did sometimes respond, not always, not consistently. But one thing I can say is I was never granted a conversation, an interview, a voice-to-voice exchange of questions and answers.
Did you ever talk – were you ever able to talk to local Department of Health officials?
They shot me right up the chain.
Yeah. At the county level, you got the same pass-through?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
I did too. I have here – I brought it into the studio with me, this Post-it note that's been hanging on my wall since July of last year. It's Tallahassee Health Department, FL. And I showed it to you before we went on the air. And you're like, oh, yeah, I know that number.
Yeah, I do.
It's been hanging on my wall right next to the Captains for Clean Water contact that I have.
Hey, they answer.
They do. I never did get an answer personally. I got the go to this website, and then based on your reporting, I knew that that website had some issues as well. Have they responded since this story has come out?
No. And since the story has come out, well, it's only been 2 days, I have sent both them and the governor's office email saying, hey, this is out in the world now. My invitation is still open. I would say that what I've done has come close to begging and nothing.
Yeah. I think it'll be interesting to see if things do change, because we've seen a different tone when it comes to the environment and water quality since the change in the governor's office.
Certainly from the governor, yes.
I'm wondering if that will trickle down. Ultimately, the governor is over the Department of Health, correct?
Yes. So. And that was the conversation that I wanted to have with the governor or whoever in his team is responsible for overseeing the various state agencies. You know, hey, is the change in direction that we've seen reflected in your administration, are we going to see that reflected in the Department of Health? So far, I haven't heard from them. I'm not quite to the point of despair with the governor's administration as I am with the health department. I still hold out hope that I may be able to have a conversation with them.
I think it's going to be interesting, too, with the chief science officer. Of course, he's just been installed fairly recently.
Yeah.
Well, the position was established and, you know, they got to get that up to speed. I wonder if that person will have oversight of science regarding the Department of Health.
That's a great question and one that one of us should ask.
Well, we'll probably be asking that after he gets his office all appointed and knows exactly what his roles are going to be. What were some of the biggest concerns that you heard repeated from the public?
Can I breathe near these blooms? The people who live right next to them, especially in the places where it was worse, the dead-end canals in Cape Coral, talk about how the smell was inside their house. And I think there's a pretty human intuition that if you can smell something foul, there's probably something that's harmful for you and you need to be careful. So these people obviously wondered, if this foul smell is in my bedroom, should I be living there? Is it safe? And one of the responses that the department gave those people, if you keep your window shut and run your air conditioner and change your filters regularly and maintain them properly, you'll probably be okay. But yeah, the basic concern. Is it safe to exist next to one of these blooms? Another question that came up all the time was, what are the long-term health effects? Are there long-term health effects of red tide? Because that was another one that lasted a year in this case. And so people were wondering about that as well. People were concerned about their pets. People were concerned about whether or not this was making its way into the drinking water supply, because the Caloosahatchee does supply water to people in the greater Fort Myers area. Those were mostly, what's it mean to me physically? What's it going to mean to me down the road?
We asked the Department of Health this, I remember, over the course of the last year, but we also asked scientists these same questions here on the show. And you were part of one of those shows when we were talking with scientists about what the effects are. And there doesn't really seem to be a ton of science there. There's some, but not conclusive enough to where scientists are willing to say out loud.
No, and they're going as fast as they can. I mean, one thing that FGCU did was that I forget what the exact term is, but it's sort of like a rapid response grant. If there's a crisis unfolding, you can quickly get money without going through a lot of the rigmarole that you usually have to do. And they did that, and they deployed sensors both next to the bloom and at varying distances.
Like a mile or so away.
Yeah, exactly. More than a mile inland. And so we're watching the science unfold. I mean, brick by brick, study by study, we are learning about this. And again, FGCU has taken a real leadership position, and I imagine the water school will accelerate those efforts further. But that was another thing that I wanted to talk to the department about. I mean, not that I was expecting them to have some paternalistic, know everything, settled science, but I just wanted to get a sense from the people making the decisions what their sense of this was, what they thought was safe, what they thought was unsafe. And again, the frustration was you couldn't even talk to them because they're the trained minds on this. And I wanted to know what their advice was.
And it was, check out this website.
Yeah.
If you're just joining the show today, I'm talking with News Press reporter Amy Bennett-Williams. Her latest feature story, which ran in last Sunday's paper, uncovers internal emails sent by key officials at the Florida Department of Health during last year's toxic blue-green algae bloom. If you'd like to ask her a question or make a comment, give us a call now at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So at one point, Governor Rick Scott's emergency declarations happened. Did that do anything when it came to the Department of Health and their actions? Did it have any impact on their responses or any actions they were taking?
Not to me, not that I saw, but we did see in the cache of emails that it was discussed a lot internally. And also a couple of lawmakers called for the CDC to intervene, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the federal agency. So they went back and forth about that. They wondered aloud or on paper electronically what this would mean and if it was going to change the way that they operated. I didn't see that. Again, I'm still reviewing these things.
Yeah.
But no, was there any edict issued following the emergency declarations? Not that I saw.
I wonder how much consideration they gave to sending it further up the chain from the Department of Health to the Centers for Disease Control.
They thought
about it. It hasn't flushed all the way out.
Yeah.
But did that declaration formally authorize any additional action?
Not with the Department of Health.
Okay.
It involved the Department of Environmental Protection. It gave money to communities affected. It authorized – it funded some small business loans, things like that. But to the best of my recollection, the Department of Health itself didn't get anything from the declaration.
I remember the small business loans, the ones that after 6 months, if you don't pay it in full, you're paying 18% interest.
Yeah.
I remember that. Retroactive to day one. Anyway, so I don't want to go down that rabbit hole. But one of the angles on the story is whether the Department of Health was doing any testing of the air. And I found it pretty interesting, the circular action of this. One of the emails was the Department of Environmental Protection's John Calhoun asking about hotspot air testing. And he says, quote, "We're getting lots of calls from citizens requesting air testing around ponds with algae blooms. We usually refer to the county, who refer them to the local health department, who refer them back to us and our Division of Air. Unfortunately, our Division of Air only does static monitoring of specific locations and doesn't have the equipment to do local testing like that. Does DOH have any ability and capacity to do such localized air testing?" The answer from Goff, which is one of the people that you ID'd as to get the emails from, "Unfortunately, we do not have any capabilities to perform air testing, localized or not. For more information on harmful algal blooms, people can be directed to our website. In general, we advise folks to take precautions around water bodies that may have harmful algal blooms. Happy to chat further."
Boom.
That's it.
Yeah.
Here's our website.
Yeah, yeah.
But but did you find anywhere in any of these emails any indication that they want to test hot spots for air quality? Did you see any movement towards fulfilling some of these requests?
You know, that was something that I was really hoping to get some response, and especially for cyanotoxins. As you know, the organisms that cause these blooms are cyanobacteria, and they produce a characteristic suite of toxins that they put into the air. And that's one of the things that FGCU has been looking at. But the department didn't. They did, toward the very end of this, go to a few places in Cape Coral and test for a sulfur component that gives it the characteristic smell. And they found a couple of places where there was sulfur – I think it was sulfur dioxide in the air.
But I mean, sulfur dioxide, you can detect that with your nose.
Correct.
I mean – okay. Sorry, go ahead.
I don't have much more. That's what they did.
I could just imagine your face while reading some of these emails like, what? Wait.
And see, this is why I'm not – after the story came out, people were very interested in it, and I got emails from colleagues saying, hey, nice get.
No, it's not – you weren't trying to get you. But
exactly.
It's like you were looking for a beam of hope, please.
I was. I just wanted to have a conversation with one of the department's scientists, and we could just talk on a human-to-human level. I wanted that kind of conversation, and still haven't gotten it. Maybe I will. Maybe this can – you know, if they hear me, they know that I'm not trying to – grab them by the collar and make them look bad. What I really wanted to do was help my audience understand what was happening around us.
And it would be nice to see if there is some kind of effort being made to identify cyanotoxins in the air.
Absolutely.
As opposed to sulfur dioxide.
Absolutely. Because it's cyanotoxins that the science, a growing body of science is showing are really concerning. They can cause tumors to grow and liver cancer, and then of course another cyanotoxin, BMAA, which of course I don't remember what that acronym is for, but that's the one that has been linked to the neurodegenerative diseases. And again, it's not settled science, but there's more and more of it with every passing month, and it would. You know, one would hope that the state's Department of Health was at least looking at that or making plans or, you know, talking about it and letting people know where it is, in what concentrations, and what they ought to do.
I don't want to be kind of an armchair speculator as to what the intention is of not really saying anything concrete, but it seems like, well, there aren't really that many incredibly clear and scientifically established truths to really share. So could their avoidance of this being, I don't really have an answer?
Absolutely could have been. And I would have liked to hear that. I don't mind when a scientist tells me, I don't know, we're looking at this. But I didn't even get to that point. I would have appreciated them saying, look, you know, the research is coming thick and fast. We're trying to synthesize it. We're trying to figure out what it means for us. We're just not there yet. But I didn't get that.
And then maybe I guess the concern was instead of coming out saying, everybody be worried about it and back away, what kind of a panic might that have induced if it turned out not to really be a thing? I mean, if you're stuck on a dead-end canal and you're inside your house smells and then the health department comes out and says, yeah, this is dangerous, or you know, if they said anything concrete, what kind of a you know mass exodus would we have seen, real estate, economics, all of that?
Right. And there already were negative impacts. I recently had a conversation with Calusa waterkeeper John Cassani, and he told me that he knows reasonable, sane people who are pulling up stakes because they're concerned about this too. So yeah, this is – I don't even like thinking about this because we live close to the river and I'm raising kids here. And but this is why it's important to have the conversations, because these are our lives. Our health is potentially at risk, and we should communicate about this.
And if it is found to actually be something that is dangerous, and if science does prove out what it's kind of starting to point to at that point, then when the Department of Health, if they were to come out and say, yeah, let's be careful about this and look at it closely, maybe that could spur more action to try to clean things up.
Clean things up. Perhaps potential interventions, you know, if there are things that you can do, measures that you can take to keep this stuff from harming you down the road. I don't know.
Toxins are tough. There's no antibiotic for those.
Right.
Those are things you just have to get work out of your system
from.
Somehow.
Yeah.
One of the people featured in the story is a man who lives on Sanibel who was pressing for answers about whether it was safe for his two young daughters to be breathing the air containing cyanobacteria toxins as well as red tide toxins. His name is Ralph Quillen. Mm-hmm. Tell me about this person's story. Did you find this person through the emails that you had requested, and then did you contact him?
I did. He's a health coach. So he's someone who is really up to speed with the human body, and they had been on vacation. They'd been out of the area for some time. And when he came back, things were in bad shape. So he fired off an email to the local Department of Health contact. And she wrote him back, and he was not satisfied with the answer. And they went back and forth several times until he got pretty cross with her and basically said, can you just give me a straight answer? And he never got his straight answer. I can tell you, though, that the emails he exchanged with the local Lee County person got sent up the chain, because I found them in the emails of the two top officials. So at least they saw his concerns.
It couldn't have been fun to be one of the local officials that's being given
no information
to give out to people.
No.
And people continue to call and be alarmed and send emails. And he literally wrote, quote, why can't I get a straight answer? And in your story says after that – he didn't get any emails back.
At least that we saw. I mean, I have
that
again,
was,
to be
that
fair
that,
to the department, perhaps they wrote him back after September 25th.
I
doubt it, but I don't know.
That would have been some lag time. We got a comment from Facebook, Deborah. She says – oh, wait. No, she called in from Bonita Springs, and she wants to ask – what the Department of Health might have done proactively. And she said, we're hearing a lot about what they didn't do, but I'm hoping that Amy Bennett Williams found something in the emails about what they might have done proactively, like reaching out to scientists elsewhere in the world, et cetera. Did you see anything to that tune? At looking at research from other parts of the world, because there are other parts of the world that have to deal with blue-green algae as well. It's
yes,
not just
there,
here.
There, I think that some people from outside the department, they may have been DEP, Department of Environmental Officials, had sent them some articles. And I do think that there was probably some reading or scrambling to read up on the research. But in terms of the department reaching out, for example, to Australia mm-hmm. or to the people who have been doing science around Lake Erie, where there have been huge blooms, I didn't see that. Again, that's not to say that it doesn't exist and they didn't do it. I just – or maybe I haven't come across it in this cache. But I don't think so, at least in this period. Again, this is only a specific period of time.
Well, I mean, you'd have to win the lottery to get the money together to get all of the information anyway with all the Freedom of Information requests, because you have to pay for these things. And if you want to get – that would be a significant amount of money.
But to Deborah's point though, one of the – Health Department people could have called me and said, hey, Amy, we're doing this. We reached out to this scientist in Australia and we reached out to this nonprofit that's been gathering data in Lake Erie, you know.
Yeah.
But I didn't get that.
You didn't see anything. But nobody's reached out to tell you that and you haven't uncovered that in the
exactly.
emails that you've gotten.
Not yet. Again, and I want to be fair too. I absolutely want to see them being advocates for the state's health.
It's kind of the name. So Lewis also called to ask if there was any directive given from the governor's office in any of these emails, which would have then been Governor Rick Scott at the time. Lewis said to his knowledge, he understood other state agencies had been told not to talk about the algal blooms publicly, and he's wondering if the same applies to the Department of Health. Did you hear anything about directives from the governor's office down to not talk about it?
I didn't. And one of the – of course, rumors like that were all over the place, that you know there was – the term was gag order. I saw no evidence of that. I did not see anything coming from the governor's office saying, dear Department of Health, don't mention this.
Yeah.
Don't talk about this. Don't answer questions. So again, it may have happened before we received this group of emails. But no, there was no, at least that I could see, edict from on high forbidding people to speak of it.
You have not found evidence of that yourself.
No.
What I find interesting is the responsibility to the Department of Health. And we're talking about being held responsible if they say this is dangerous, if they say it isn't dangerous. If it turns out that these toxins are dangerous, which it, as you mentioned many times, the body of science is pointing to the direction that, yeah, they are. And the Department of Health has not done any of the air testing, has not checked on that, and they haven't warned people to stay away from this. Is the Department of Health setting itself up for a liability situation in which they could be sued by citizens who had not been protected?
Good question. And the other question too is who's responsible for testing fish tissue? Who's responsible for testing blue crabs? There were people crabbing in the Caloosahatchee throughout the worst of the blooms. There's some of the literature that they dispensed says that muscle tissue doesn't collect this stuff. But I did find scientists who differed with that. So, yeah.
How much agreement does there have to be with science, within the scientific community, before something is accepted to be a fact? If you have 10 scientists who say that this stuff does not collect in the muscular tissue, but you have 20 other scientists who say it does, who makes that call?
You know, I don't know. And I don't know if the department does. But what the department could do is say 10 say this, 20 say this. You, public, you decide. It would be nice if they aggregated the best research, quantified it, and then gave it to us and we could make our own decisions.
Another email exchange on August 17th, Joellen Bavosa wrote asking, quote, when will you help? When will you start testing? When will you issue warnings to the public about cyanobacteria? This is not just red tide anymore, and it has not been for a long time. We hope that your agency will step forward and help. Reich didn't write Bavosa back, but he did send that email on to a colleague saying this, quote, there really is nothing we can say to address this email, Andy. Did that surprise you to read that?
By that point, no. I mean, I felt bad for the people who were at the other end of these emails. You know, I can only imagine what it was like for Andy to get these day after day. And so, no, I wasn't surprised. I felt bad for Andy.
Mm-hmm. And then there's another category of questions about warning posting signs, posting warning signs.
Correct.
Whose responsibility is it to post these signs?
Well, initially the health department in no uncertain terms said that it was not its responsibility. And I went back and forth with them on that. But apparently after I published a story that said, no, the health department doesn't do this, some other agencies, the Corps of Engineers, which maintains the Franklin Locks, and Lee County, which operates some boat ramps near areas of bloom, started making signs using old health department. I think they would just take a health department handout, laminate it, and stick it on a post. Mm-hmm. And when the health department, I believe, reconstructing from email exchanges, saw this, then they decided, okay, we'd better step up. They never told me. They never circled back to me and said, oh, okay, Amy, now we're starting to post signs. But I think ultimately they did, probably a few hundred. Did they communicate that with me? No. But they did decide at some point in this crisis that, yes, they would physically make and post signs, which is a good thing.
And what did the signs say? This area has cyanobacteria?
Basically, yeah. Watch out.
Watch out.
Yeah.
Don't
go in.
Don't go swimming.
Keep your pets out of it. Because – and that – you know, another story follow-up that I want to do is what the animal population experienced with the cyanotoxins. I've had anecdotally several people say, you know, my terrier got deathly ill, or my dog died after going in one of these blooms. So I do think that that was addressed in the signage to keep the animals away from it.
I remember at one point there was a person evading police, evading arrest, and he jumped into a canal.
Yes.
That was full. I wonder how he's doing.
That's a great question.
Another follow-up.
Made for some good video.
Yeah. At one point, the emails discussed media coverage, including national stories in the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, expressing relief that they hadn't been called out by name.
Yeah.
So they
yeah.
were paying attention to what was being reported, and they didn't really like it.
Oh, they were paying attention. Sure, sure. And they, one of the stories that I did got passed around, and one of the asides from one of my email people was, you know, by the way, this does not portray us in a positive light.
Yeah, well, and then it says it's a shame we can be misquoted so easily. No wonder we get the calls that we do from citizens confused on this topic.
Hey, that was a TV story, by the way.
Oh, well, yeah. it happens, but it's
sure.
It's just communication is difficult anyway, but when there's no communication coming out from the Department of Health, it's very difficult, and you just keep getting pointed to
sure.
a website.
Sure, sure.
Wow. I'm talking with News Press reporter Amy Bennett-Williams. During this part of today's show, we're exploring her reporting on what was happening inside the Florida Department of Health during last year's toxic algae bloom in the Caloosahatchee River and its estuary. If you'd like to make a comment or ask a question, give us a call. The number is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Your story ends by talking about how it's still unclear how the Department of Health is going to respond if we see another major blue-green algae bloom. And there was a story just this morning saying that there is still blue-green algae out there that's showing up in some testing areas. What do you foresee happening at this point?
Well, I think if the department behaves as it did, that it will take responsibility for signage. But one of the interesting things that happened as a result of its reticence is that other agencies, groups, businesses, healthcare systems stepped in to fill the gap. Lee Health, following the lead of Martin Health over on the other side of the state, began collecting information from all of its patients in the urgent care centers and walk-in clinics and emergency departments and the physicians that work in its system. They started gathering information about exposure and contact and symptoms. Calusa Waterkeeper got a grant from the Southwest Florida Community Foundation to do some education and outreach and things that one might expect a health department to do. So there have been this – and FGCU too has – along with Florida Atlantic University, has been doing research and trying to get that information out there. Again, things that the department might have done but didn't, but now these nonprofits and educational groups yeah. are doing it.
And also reporters trying to sort through all this stuff. I mean, there are so many armchair scientists out there that are on Facebook discussing things that they are saying are 100% truth, and being able to filter through all of that
yeah.
is a challenge as a reporter as well.
It is indeed. And people are scared. And when people are scared, the rumors fly thick and fast and the conspiracy theories come up. And, you know, we have to monitor social media and we have to pay attention to what people are saying, because if nothing else, it reflects the community's concerns. But we also try not to fall prey to this lurid speculation too.
It's a tough line to walk. I'm walking it with you. I understand. Tell me a little bit about the importance of the Sunshine Act and being able to get details like what you found in these emails.
Well, the whole idea is that we are the government. We pay for the government. We pay the salaries. These people are acting for us and on our behalf. And therefore, as their bosses, we ought to know what they're doing. We ought to be able to evaluate their performance. And that's one of the things that government in the sunshine is all about. We can see how our government is performing, and we are able to evaluate what it's doing. Maybe it's not being effective. And if that's the case, and this is where the media plays a really important role, we can bring that to our lawmakers, and theoretically we can get things changed. We can make agency changes. We can have the lawmakers do that for us.
It shows how critically important local media is too.
No kidding.
Because will this show up on a national radar? It would not have been uncovered from a national point of view, but after a local reporter uncovers it, it was shared through USA Today Network.
Sure.
This, do you sense that this might end up becoming a bigger story?
I hope so. I hope, you know, one of the things that I want to do is look at what areas in the country who are going through similar things are doing. It would, on my list of to-dos, is check with communities around Lake Erie and see what struggles they've had.
Ohio State Department of Health.
Exactly. Yeah. How they have communicated about this with the population. So, yeah, this is exactly why local news is important. If we weren't out, I mean, paying for these things and then communicating about them, we wouldn't know.
Yeah, we'd have no idea. We have a call coming from Peter in Naples who has a question. Peter, what would you like to ask?
Yes, I was wondering why no one has not sought out a private company to have the air test done. And I believe that the reason that all the government agencies are sort of like kicking it around and not really doing much about this situation is that there's so much big money involved in the reason that we have the problem in the first place, which is the fertilizer runoff from the billionaires who are doing the farming and the sugarcane. The runoff from those is what's causing it, and no one wants to go there.
All right, Peter, thank you for your question. We'll have the answer off air. Have you heard of anybody with a private organization or a private company trying to do any kind of air or water quality testing?
Water quality, yes. I have not heard of any private labs or private nonprofits doing air testing. Again, FGCU is doing some air testing, but Colusa Waterkeeper, for example, is one of the nonprofits that samples and takes their samples to a private lab. So they sometimes, in the same places that the Department of Environmental Protection are testing, they're running their own parallel tests, which I think is can only be a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any final thoughts that you'd like to share before I cut you loose? I've kept you in the seat longer than I should have.
Oh, I'm, you know,
I can sit here and talk to you all day.
I want to the Department of Health, to the governor's office, I want to talk. I want to tell my audience, my community, what you want them to know. It's okay if you don't have all the answers. I would just at least like to share your thoughts. To people who are living with this, living through this, please connect. If you have concerns, let me know, because at the very least, I'm getting a sense of what our community is thinking about and what you want to know, and I can direct my coverage that way.
Yeah. Well, that is all the time that we have for this part of the show, but I want to thank my guest. Amy Bennett-Williams is an environmental reporter and storyteller for the News Press. Her essays can also be heard Friday mornings at 8:45 here on WGCU. Shameless plug by me because I love them. Amy, thanks so much for your time and your work on this still developing story.
Thank you for having me.
When we return, we're going to meet the two filmmakers, a father and son, behind a new documentary that tells the 40-year story of the Rookery Bay National Estuarine Research Reserve and its ongoing work to protect the fragile ecosystem between Marco Island and Naples. I'm Julie Glenn, and you're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.